Okay. So the guest has final cut on everything, Mark. So I'll edit this at some point in time. I'll send you a copy, and you might say, "Can you cut this out?" You might say, "Can I re-record this answer? Can you re whatever you need, I will do it." So you have final cut. Like some people have just said things they wish they wouldn't have said or violated an NDA. Like who knows, right? So just yeah. So I'm not going to air anything unless I have your final permission on that. Yeah, of course. And I appreciate you joining. So great. Great. So hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Whiteboard Podcast. The guest today is Mark Jenkinson. Mark graduated from Humber College's Advertising and Graphic Design program in 2012. The first few years of his career were spent at various digital agencies in Toronto, like Navigator, Article, and Nascent, working first as a graphic designer, then as a UI/UX designer, and eventually as a product designer. In 2016, Mark joined Trello as a product designer, where he has been for the last 7 years. During that time, Mark worked both as a product designer and as a design manager. After 7 years at Trello, Mark has recently left and is now taking a career sabbatical before determining what to do next. Thank you very much, Mark. It's so good to talk to you again. It's so good to see you again. Yeah, so, okay. Well, the reason I thought it would be great to have you on the podcast is because we are primarily a advertising and graphic design program, as the name would suggest. Right, but we so many students who, once they're kind of exposed to the wider world of design, they say, "Oh, maybe I want to do web. Maybe I want to do X, do UX, and now maybe I want to do product." And so I thought maybe you could kind of let us know what the difference is sort of between web, UX, UI, product, but also how someone who studied something sort of adjacent to that can transform their future and find themselves in that career path. Right. Yeah, that is something that, I guess a decade ago, I don't think there were. There might have been UX programs, but I read a statistic, on like a Nielsen Norman Group thing where it said basically in 1990 there were three UX designers in the world, and then in 2000 there was 300, and then in 2010 there was like 30,000, and now there's like 3 million, or it's something like that. It's exploding. Yep. You're so right. It's super challenging. I mean, we don't go too deep into web. We do 1 semester in Figma, doing just a typical website, e-commerce homepage, category page, product item page, cart page sort of thing. Just because that's a nice framework to get the basics, right? But half a semester of HTML, CSS. But I'm kind of more interested in, whatever your education is, something that's backed by design fundamentals, regardless of the sort of software involved and the outputs involved. How did you get steered into the more digital end? Cool. It's great to hear that. I guess it's like appropriate to hear that an engineer sort of shifted the thinking away from design as sort of an engineering thing, because I guess UX sort of really started in built worlds. There's people who say like, oh, UX has been around since the 50s. And people were just building things that people had to touch and use, and or at least the 70s, when factories in Scandinavia were being redesigned for around the worker and how the worker uses machines so their elbows don't explode after 20 years and stuff like that. I think that sort of mindset, like design in general, needs to kind of shift away from sort of being an art form to being an engineering form. That makes any sense? So when you were at, when you started working as a graphic design, and then within a workplace, your role kind of shifted. Is that correct? Cool. And what about the growth of development knowledge at the same time? Was that a thing, or were you just purely focused on the design?
Right.
Cool. So let me tell you what I think you're saying, and then you'll tell me if I've got it right. Okay. So maybe a developer sends you a card, and it's a typical card. There's a product image at top, and then underneath is an H1, then there's an H2, and then there's some body. And you right-click, and you inspect, and you add a little bit more margin between the headings, and then you're like, can we get it like this? Is that kind of what you mean? Okay. Okay, cool. So, okay, good. So for anyone listening, that's very, very, very doable. And don't be intimidated. And I just say that because a lot of people right away, they just kind of shut out, like, I can never do it, right? I don't want people to think that. So what are some of the other conversations, maybe more early on, you know, like pre-development stage, before there's anything to inspect, like conversations with the developer about maybe responsive design, and are they looking at it, your work in, say, Figma, and saying, what's going to happen when, you know, when we hit this certain breakpoint, for example? Cool. And I guess moving into a management position, having sort of an amount of knowledge of what everyone on your team is doing is probably also pretty useful. All right. So product design, what does that mean? That's awesome. So it really is the full picture. It's so true. Many, many people can make Illustrator go and do things. And I think it's less and less important, actually, with AI, sort of democratizing those tools, right? Like, it's really going to boil down to, do you know how to make people happy in a very, very broad sense? Fulfilled, even, I think might be a better word than happy. Yeah, I mean, definitely, because it's something like Illustrator. It's like, this is how a Bezier curve works, and eventually you'll figure it out, right? Like, this is the button you press to make the handle go this way and be a corner or not a corner or a curve or whatever. But it's like, how do you tell someone, here's how you can improve, or here's how I see it and why I see it that way? That's difficult. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. One of the like things that in the limited amount of web and UX design I've worked on, one of the things that comes up a lot is, at least I've noticed it come up, two people can disagree and both be right. And so what's the manifestation of that in a single design? Right. And that's a hard conversation to have. Right? And sometimes, like, as a designer, you're kind of caught in the middle of these parties, and it could be, you know, there's a product owner who sees it one way and the user see it another way, and your designer sees it another way. And it's kind of like, oh dear, like, what do we do? Yeah, I can maybe put an example out there, one I just happened to stumble across recently. It's an Apple story, and I hate to use Apple stories because everyone does, but it's got the strong leader component and the designer component and the user component. So, 2006, they're about to launch the iPhone in a year, iPhone 1, and they're going with a plastic screen. And they're going with a plastic screen because when you drop your phone, plastic doesn't shatter, right? And the first generation of iPhones ended up being glass, which of course does shatter. I've shattered a half a dozen screens. And so Jobs, the manager, Steve Jobs, wanted plastic screens because they were more durable. And that was kind of the bottom line. People dropped their phones, and that we don't want to get bad press about that. But the designers eventually kind of were advocating for glass screens. And kind of the final reason was that if you put a phone in your purse or if you put a phone in your pocket, that's normal use. That's what people do. But if there's skis or change in your pocket, plastic will scratch. If you drop your phone, that's not normal use. And it's air quotes, your fault for dropping your phone. So if you shatter the glass, that's your fault. If you scratch it, a plastic, that's Apple's fault. And so this argument, I suppose, this perspective changed Jobs' mind. Wherever you stand on this in the long term, I don't know what the right choice was, but it was this intersection sort of user and manager and designer sort of all coming together. Yeah. And I work on a lot of small teams, especially when I'm doing web design projects. And a lot of times we don't have access to a significant amount of data, right? We have basically maybe one or two people who use the thing talking to us and the manager or the product owner. What are some tools you can use if you don't have lots of data for shaping a product? Yeah. Right. Yeah, I feel like there's sort of there are ways like defined ways of getting at the story behind the story. Like five whys kind of thinking. And those can work. Those can be valuable. Someone I always keep in mind when I'm making something is actually my mom, because I feel like she represents like a reasonable amount of knowledge and a reasonable amount of willingness to sort of make it work. Like some people are like, it doesn't work, bye. And some people are like, I will fight until this happens, right? And then there's someone in between, so that's my mom. So I kind of always like try to talk to her when I'm working on things. But yeah, she deserves, I'll take her out. I usually take her out for wings or a beer or something. So yeah, it's tricky. And I guess the reason I asked about that is because for people who find themselves moving out of advertising and design, or just print design and branding and into digital, they very often are that designer who is getting this things added to them by people who perhaps don't know that you're asking way more than you're giving them the tools to achieve. I don't know if that resonates with you when you were starting into a digital role, but definitely. Sure. So the reason I asked what some tools you use to inform your product and UX design choices when there's no data is because a lot of designers coming from the print design and the traditional design world will find themselves on teams where they are being asked to do big UX things or big product things without the support of a product-focused team or a UX-focused team. And so maybe when you're at Navigator, that was your experience. It was like, hey, we need you to completely understand this huge picture and design for it in a way that, understands the huge picture, but we're not giving you any resources to do that. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you're self-flagellating a little bit. Like I should have asked, should have done things differently. But there's also sometimes it's like if you're not the kind of person who just goes for it, then it's hard to grow, especially grow across domains. So like on the one hand, you're like, oh, I should have done better. I should have done things differently, or I should have understood what I didn't understand. But at the same time, if you don't have a bit of boldness, you're just going to be doing what you're doing, and there's no growth. Yes, don't be so hard on yourself, Mark. Yeah, but I do also totally appreciate, like, if this is what you're saying, there's so much you don't know until you make the mistake. And maybe if you could find someone who could get in front of that for you, you'll grow faster. Your life will be easier. Your job will be easier. Yeah. Right. Are you able to describe sort of day in the life of product design, or like, I don't know, maybe you work with an agile workflow and you're going through those steps. Where are you in each of those steps? Is that something that is possible to break down? Yep. Yeah. Right. This is that it's about people as much as it is about the thing again. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, institutional friction, it's something that exists like everywhere, right? Like it's not just in product design. You're gonna encounter it anywhere. I don't want people to feel like, wait, I'll never be designing. It's like, no, you will.
You.
And what kind of are you able to talk about like what sort of products, maybe not brand, if you can genericize it, that's great. Like, are you doing banking apps? Are you doing internal, like a POS internal point of sale program? Like, what kind of? I better explain. Kanban is a design framework. Yeah. And do you do a lot of customizations for specific clients of Trello, or is it one product and everyone gets it and then that's it? Yeah, I mean, it's not an uncommon story for many products. Like, it's like people just start using it in ways you kind of didn't expect. And then your reaction is to like, okay, well, let's continue to capture this persona. And then it's like, it just gets big. And I mean, Trello's huge, but their related products like Confluence, for example, is also freaking huge. Like, and there's like overlap between the two, I guess, a little bit in terms of who's using them. So, yeah, I guess that's another thing. Like, I'm interested to hear what you think about the question of, I guess, very, very large, flexible products that are in it become complex versus targeted products that are simple, but kind of just do one thing. The sort of the steam whistle answer versus the like the Molson Coors Anheuser-Busch answer to product design. Yeah, it's tricky. Like, because more like my instinct is always no. I just want I like. Oh man, it's so weird. Actually, I don't think I have a defined stance on this, because if I think about something like a knife, I just want an 8-inch chef knife, and that's what I'll use for everything in the kitchen. I don't need a paring knife. I don't need whatever. Right. I don't need a boning knife. But in like my wood shop, it's like, no, I need these specific kinds of saws to cut these specific kinds of materials. And I would never want some kind of multi-saw that cuts everything. Or like, I love the fact that my iPhone does everything except make phone calls now. You know what I mean? I guess it's like, man, it's a really hard question. I guess it's the flexibility, usability trade-off. And I'm constantly struggling with it. Even if I write an assignment for students, I'm like, okay, I'll just get like a super specific assignment. But then it's like, well, what's the point? Because it's so prescriptive that, you know, it's dumb. But then if it's like, just do whatever you want, it's kind of like, well, then what should I do? You know? Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe something that's more in your wheelhouse is like SharePoint. Is like you can do so much with share, like you can do so much with SharePoint that I don't even really know what it is anymore. Right? Like really though, is it? Well, it's a good thing for me if you pay me to figure it all out, and if you pay everyone else in the company to figure it out, and you give them the time and you set that aside. But if you're like, if you go to market with this product that's like, hey, what does it do? And you just like shrug your shoulders and Microsoft says basically everything, like workflows, you know, authoring, file sharing, wikis, like you can do everything with it. But very few people, I mean, I guess the extreme example is a programming language, right? It's like, if you learn, for example, C, it's like, well, you could do anything, but it's like, well, then what do you do? Or like, who do you do it for? And so on and so on. So I don't know, like, I'm always thinking about this. Right. Interesting. There should be like a word for whatever it is you just described. Like there should be a word for that sort of user uncertainty. Yeah. Like, and what if there's leftover Lego pieces that you just, they're always there. You've never used them, but they're always in the bottom of the box for some reason. But I feel like that was so much software, right? You're kind of like, why is this? Like, just think about your operating system and how many few, there's so many things in there which you'll never touch. You don't even know they're there to be used. You know, you don't even hear them jingling in the bottom of the box. Operating system is a bad example, but like even InDesign, right? Like there are tools in InDesign, like which in 10 years, I've never used them. I don't even know what they are. Yeah. It's kind of like you built Iron Man, and then there's nowhere to put the thing in the glowing thing in the chest, right? Like it's there, and you're like, yeah. I mean, I guess some solutions are like workspaces, right? So when you're in InDesign, you can choose to be in the proofing workspace or the typography workspace, or you know whatever and whatever the other workspaces are, and then so perhaps. If you are a typographer and you work in editorial, you set it to the typography workspace and you never change it because this is basically defining your wheelhouse, right? So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's like some opportunity to make people feel like they're not missing anything that they should not miss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I meant like on a small scale, you know, within a thing. Amazing. What's in here? Okay. I'm going to go through the list here. Oh, we didn't talk about how you got your internship. We can, if you want to, it's a huge, students always want to know, like, how do I get an internship? How do I get an internship? Another thing that a lot of students will want to know, and probably more, is what makes a good case study, and specifically as a manager evaluating a portfolio of a potential hire, what are you looking for? And you could get like very specific, like here's how it should be formatted, or you could get like broadly speaking, here's what I think, if you're comfortable. Okay, so I'll launch us into it based on what we were just saying. Yeah, we could probably make a product together. But if you were going to evaluate a final product, or for example, a portfolio piece or a case study, as a manager, maybe looking to hire a junior, what are some of the ways you evaluate that? How do you look at someone's portfolio and say, this person is, you know, the kind of person I'm looking for? About people, and once again, yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing I say is that the hiring process is basically a risk mitigation heuristic. And if you can figure out how that individual and the institution mitigate risk, you'll get hired. Or like it'll be some other reason why you don't get hired. And one of the risks is not getting home on time. So how do you portray that you're the person who gets everyone home on time? I guess preparation is one way. Another thing you said that you mentioned being kind of meta about it, and I'll share an example of when I saw that recently. It was a case study, and it had the usual beats, but then the kind of the hook, like the full width 100 VH like image graphic with the big quote was what I learned and what I would do differently. And I was like, oh man, that's good, because it's like, you're showing that vulnerability, you're showing that willingness to grow, but it's also like the thing that the evaluator didn't already know, right? And it was like, wow, that's cool. So yeah, super meta, and showing growth and showing, I guess, vulnerability, but in a way that somehow makes you strong. Like, I don't know. Yeah, we call it the 9 out of 10 Photoshop paradox. It's like, because if you think you're a 9 out of 10 in Photoshop, you don't know enough about Photoshop.
Huh.
Well, because it's so deep, right? Like, you might be a 9 out of 10 on drawing, but you're probably not 9 out of 10 on drawing, photo editing, mockups, and so on and so on and so on. So yeah, that level of confidence is difficult. Okay, cool. So yeah, those are good case studies, and I love the interview tips. They're always super good. Another, like, I always like it when someone in an interview has something like insightful or intelligent to say about the work done by the company they're applying for or to. But I guess that can be tricky, right? Because I guess you could kind of set yourself up to say something that's, I guess, wrong, or maybe doesn't have the information to be as insightful as you think. I don't know. Right.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say like, yeah, man, it's really about people. You could just say like, you know, I notice sometimes this thing about the product, and I'm just wondering like, what are some of the challenges involved there? Because I feel like it's kind of a big beast to wrestle, and they'll probably know right away what you're doing, which is a good thing. Yeah. Yeah, it takes a little pressure off you too, job interview. Okay, so that's great about case studies and a great breakdown. Problem statements are something that are kind of, you know, you hear, oh, you first develop and then you define, and you end up with a how might we at the bottom of the diamond. These problem statements, is there anything you can unpack about those or demystify, or like, what is the goal of a problem statement, and why is a problem statement helpful or not? Right. Oh, yeah. Any, do you have any like examples you can provide? I know it's not always allowed to share. It's a good example. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Awesome. Mark. Some people making noise. I'm just going to go ask them to be quiet.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh my God.
Thank you. Our audios are isolated, so it probably shouldn't even matter, but it's supposed to be like a quiet area. That's the whole point. So anyways, thank you. Great. I'm in G. So I don't know if G was like getting renoed when we were here. So there's got some like really... Yeah. Do you see like a bay window? Yeah, so I think they just redid this. And if we go up a level, it's all like all of the sort of peak and shapy windows. So like I don't know, can we see the roof? No, we can't. But all the roof here, there, we can see that roof. So you're in the roof. So all the ceilings are like that, and it's all exposed brick. Yeah, they did a really good job.
Really good job.
Yeah, I liked it too. Like, I showed up not knowing anything about graphic design, like never even opening any software. And then when I left, I was just like, this is really interesting. Like, I just left thinking this is interesting and I want more. Yeah. Wow. Okay, this has been amazing. What else? Okay, so these are some notes here. What is product design? How did you end up where you are? How you got your internship, your story from school to industry, what makes a good case study, what do you look for in juniors, reflections on what you did in school versus the demand of the job. I feel like we covered a lot of that. I don't know. Is there anything else you think we should get into? We've been recording, we're at an hour 10, and 45 minutes is usually what I cut down to. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I guess we might be about the same age because I also did a BA before Humber. And I think it's got something to do with the length of this program, which is 2 years. It attracts a lot of people who have previous education. So a lot of listeners, what you just said is totally going to resonate with them because they find themselves in the same boat. What's your degree in? There's no way that doesn't help you every single day in your product design role.
Okay.
I see. Interesting. Yeah, I shouldn't have spoke. I don't know anything about what exactly a BCom entails. I'm literature and history, and like every single day, like reading a story and then having it provoke thought, that's what history and literature is. And that's what I do every time. Like, that's what design is. The human aspect, anyways, of design. Hearing stories, and they get you going. And, oh, here's a perspective. And how does that map on to the real world, a social structure, a narrative? So anyone with a degree out there who is thinking about design, there's a good chance it'll be useful. You haven't wasted your time. Yeah. Yeah, but I trust you. Also, OCAD is really overrated. Probably. Oh, well, I mean, they do it fully. You could do it fully remote. So, it'd be great. We could chat again. We could chat now if you want. I don't know how much time you have, but we could just completely abandon the podcast at this point if you do have questions about that.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that? I'm happy to. Okay. The best thing I've ever heard said about it is that it's what you make of it. So, one amazing thing. I met my wife there, which is awesome. We just got married last December. And I enrolled because I hated my day job. I was working at a law firm, 9 to 5, you know, started at payment X, 2 years later, making, you know, X plus one. And yet I've upskilled like motion graphics, web design, and photography and videography. So I was just like, okay, I need to do something. And I was like, I guess I could go to grad school. I don't know why. I knew full well it's all about the portfolio. But I enrolled and I got in. And I guess my first impression was none of these faculties have industry experience. And, you know, one of them had been an architect and a project manager. She ran the architecture company and was a practicing architect. So I had so much respect for her because that's what you need, right, at that level. The mentorship of a business professional, but also of a true designer, the craft and the people. But other than that, it was just people who had just been in academia forever and ever. And a lot of my peers were from all over the place. And I recognized the value in that. And when I say all over the place, like degrees in dance and degrees in economics and degrees in some architecture and so on, but again, many of them straight out of their undergrad. So it there was a lot of like stuff in it that was just very, I don't need to be here for this is not graduate school level, and I hate to be a snob, but I was just kind of like, I am not sleeping because I'm doing this while I work my full-time job, and I'm coming to this classroom, and why? So there's that. And then they kind of like, they really push inclusive method as something special, and it has knowledge that doesn't exist in any other domain or discipline or any other approach to design. And I really resented that. Because they were saying things that like as if they were brand new, And I was like, no, this knowledge is 30 years old. Like Don Norman wrote about this. We all know this. So that sort of just, it really got under my skin. And I think allowing that to bother me right from the get-go, those three things, the fact that there wasn't true new knowledge and old knowledge was being repackaged in a way that appropriated it, I guess, and said, this is ours. The fact that my peers weren't like part of my tribe, but not so much that. Actually, that's not true. The fact that I was having to go through their onboarding when I felt like I should have been privileged, I guess. The third one there was the fact that the faculty, in my opinion, didn't know anything I didn't. So it's course based with a major research paper, MRP they call it, which also bothered me because I'm putting like so much work into this and it's not somehow on par with a thesis, which I'm over it now. But at the time, when you're paying $30,000 a year and you're quitting your job so you can do this and so on, these little things get under your skin. Yeah. And then I'm doing all these courses and half the time I'm like, fuck this, I don't need it. The only thing I really enjoyed was the research and the research paper. And I was kind of like, why can't this just be a thesis program where I write the paper and leave? Because that's kind of what grad school is supposed to be. And then the final thing that really left a bad taste in my mouth is seeing what passed muster and like reading other people's research papers. Mark, there it's open. I can send you the repository. It's open information. Like, I'll give you an example. If a dog, sometimes dog has no back legs, so you make a little wheelchair and you strap it to the back of the dog. This person's graduate thesis was just that, which already existed. And there was like some little additions, some little incremental, better mousetrap kind of additions. But like, you're not making a contribution to the design world. You're not using the inclusive method tools. I was so angry now that I felt like this debased everything I did. Yeah. So there you go. So that's my experience. However, at the end of the day, I'm proud of what I wrote and it got me, it opened up some opportunities for me. It got me work. It got me hired as a teacher. But at the same time, I feel like sooner or later, someone's going to find out that that it's all bullshit. At least though, I can, yeah, go ahead. So I have a little, so my graduate advisor taught in more than one program and she is no longer there. She left. Because every program she touched, she felt like this is not what it needs to be. Yeah, you know, it's a real shame. It's a shame because there's so much goodwill and there's so much money and there's so much energy and there's so many resources, but they refuse. To them, they see standards or like, what am I trying to say? They see anything, any amount of prescriptive, any amount of like, we should be kind of up here as excluding people who are not there or people who they feel like they're closing doors rather than, you know, adding a level to the elevator. Yeah. So that's the problem. Yeah, I'll tell you something, like the way we talk about what we did at Humber is nowhere near the way anyone ever talks about OCAD. Yeah, like I feel like Humber, like even if I never worked as a graphic designer again, I would go back to Humber. You know what I mean? Like if I graduated from graphic design and I ended up working, like for example, like Neil works as a train engineer now. He won't tell you that he regrets going to Humber. He'll say like, no, Humber's a good school. I enjoyed it. And I learned a lot. But the only thing about OCAD is that it was just a hoop I had to jump through. That just makes me sad. I went from angry to sad. Universally. Yeah, I haven't met anyone who was like, basically it's like we, and you can say, oh, the student body is the school, and that is a fair thing to say, but literally the school contributes nothing. Nothing. And I think one time I said to an instructor, I don't need to pay OCAD so that I can write a research paper. And she just was like stunned, and she was like, well, I guess that's true. And I was like, I just need the, and yeah, so anyways, yeah, there you go. So I did one summer and one winter. So it was summer, fall, winter. And the summer is, they call it an intensive. It's like 2 weeks of 9 to 5. So I did that. And then I did the first semester. At the end of the first semester, I started passing out. I collapsed at the gym. Yeah, and so I went to a doctor, and I went to MRIs and neurologists. They're like, there's nothing wrong with you. You're fine. I passed out again. I went back to the doctor. And she's like, finally, she was just like, how much do you sleep? And I was like, oh, about 5 hours a night. Because I was in Durham region, commuting to Toronto, then going to school after my 9 to 5. And she was just like, you're passing out because you don't sleep enough. And I was like, oh, fuck, right. So then it was really good. I quit my job. I started taking freelance work part-time and doing school. And it was like perfect. I hit a groove, and that was like amazing. So. I'll tell you something though. If you're going to do it remote, if you're going to do it from New York and you have a clear vision, you have like a really interesting research proposal, do it. Because just phone in all of the classes, turn on, like it doesn't sound great, but you will be fulfilled if you just pay lip service to the course-based part and focus on your research and make something you're proud of. And then you'll have that artifact. And no one will be able to take that away from you. So I guess, yeah, that's, yeah. Which, did you look at the different programs? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's not going to hurt you. I mean, I think it was 30, 35K a year. That's for three semesters. Canadian. No, per year. Yeah. 60, 70K total. And so there's two weeks in the summer where you do 9 to 5, and then it's like course based and mostly in the evenings, because it's so I think it was like four or five nights a week for the regular school year. And you know, 3 hour online lectures. I chose to go in just because I really wanted to, like, I was like super enthusiastic about it at first, and I was like, I really want to make the most of this. So I was going in and I was like wearing dress pants and everything. And anyways, so yeah, so if you just do it, you know, the knowledge that they do about inclusion, really, really like the novelty, I guess. I don't mean novelty in a disparaging way. I mean like genuinely like the newness of it is just this idea of start your design process from edge cases and look at excluded users. Start from the excluded user. And if you design for them, then you will capture the sort of glut of average in the middle. And look, I can point to the world and give you a dozen examples when that's true. I can give you a dozen examples when it's not. We already know that, right? And I almost felt it was like abusive because the professors would point to every single example where they're correct. And I would be like, oh, what about like this thing? And they'd be like, shut up. Or like they would say anything that's designed for edge case users usually gets adopted by everyone or is useful to everyone. So they'd point out a curb cut and say, if you're a skateboarder, if you use a stroller, if you're on a bicycle, if you're on a one wheel, then you love a curb cut, which was invented for wheelchair riders, or a power door. And I'm like, great. What about do you know what a sip and puff machine is? It's a tool for if you have no mobility in your hands, you can control the mouse with basically a giant straw. And then when you blow into it, it clicks. No one's going to use that, right? And the teacher actually said to me, she's like, well, Eric, that's a very extreme example. And I was like, well, your fundamental principle is here that the extreme edge cases, designs for them will be adopted by the group. That's what you're trying to tell me this is all about. So I would get very frustrated. And the constant attacks on the existing design profession, I understand that. I understand the ivory tower anger. And I understand that there's like a regression towards mean. I understand those things. But making those accusations and stripping any context is incredibly, it's dishonest. Yeah. Rant over. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm teaching typography, which I love, and I teach web. So we do, it's called Media Technology is the name of the course, but we're Figma. So, you know, I basically just do 12 column layout with, homepage. And then there's like those content sections that are very who we are, what we do, the benefit, the final call to action, a footer, a hero. And then a category page with cards, and the cards have a hierarchy. And then there's the filtered. And then we do... And that's kind of like the main assignment for that. Oh, product page and cart page. That's the main assignment there. And then I help them set up their portfolios. So WordPress, I let them pick whatever they want, but I encourage WordPress just because like Dreamhost with WordPress, it's like $6 a month for unlimited everything. And it includes your domain. So you really can't beat it. And 40% of the websites on the internet are WordPress. So if you know that platform, you just opened up a lot of opportunity. And then I teach motion graphics. Yeah, After Effects, which is hilarious because those are my lowest grades. I think I had like a 68 in David Newman taught the Flash. I think I had like a 68. And I think Kevin Brandon taught Dreamweaver. And I had like a 70 because I hated it. I wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had this realization the other day that I will never get better at my profession, right? Because I don't, it's not because I've reached any, as a designer, I'm so far from the best, right? In every possible way you can measure that. And I'll never get better because I no longer have the time to devote to the craft. So it was kind of like being 37 and realizing you've peaked is very depressing. You know what I mean? And sometimes I get bored because I'm like, holy fuck. Like I find myself like, how can you not understand H1, H2, P? Like, how can you not fucking see that? And it's just like, Eric, this person's 19 years old. You know, they've never thought about it this way. And it's also the first time you've told this person that was last year that you said it three times, you know. So I don't know if I'll be able to do it forever. That's what I'm saying. Yes. You know what? That, so I use that in my interviews, and it seems to have struck a chord. Like I said, I was not happy with my education in many places, and that I want people to be happy. Like that propels me to make other people happy in their learning. And that seems to have struck a chord, because otherwise there's nothing special about me. Anyone could teach type, right? Like it's not. So, yeah. Yeah. Maybe. Thank you. Maybe. We'll find out. Let's give it time. Yeah, well, I mean, if you're ever interested in teaching and you're ever back in the area, you should definitely look us up, because if you just want part-time, there's almost always opportunity. Yeah, so you should definitely check it out. And, like, the colleges are constantly hiring part-time staff. It's kind of part-time is kind of a bummer, but if you just want to try it out, it's super rewarding. And, you know, you could even look for anyone teaching online, and maybe you don't even have to like worry about where you are. I teach at Seneca online once a week, in addition to Humber. So I just mean like there's work. If you just do one course a week and do it online, yep. Maybe, although we'll see. Like, because right now the challenge is the colleges are full because of international students, and you know, moving here now versus moving here 10 years ago is a completely different proposition, right? Like it would be scary 10 years ago. So will the international community start to say, oh, if I move into Canada and I get a job as a graphic designer and I make $60,000 a year in Toronto, I'm not going to have a good life. Like, so I think we're going to see international enrollment drop, which means that enrollment will drop, because like Conestoga is like 70% international. Humber, I think, is around 40. So some schools are more insulated against this than others. But yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe. But at the end of the day, like when we're talking about some countries, like India has 1.3 billion people. It doesn't take a large percentage to be okay with it to fail Humber College, right? So, but as the number of people who want to come here drops, that might start to become a factor. I guess we'll see. It's, yeah, and you know, you mentioned how when we were in high school, it was like, don't go to college. Like you'll be poor, you'll be dumb, you'll be, yeah. That's happening again. And I know that because I was just talking to the dean about enrollment numbers, and he said the colleges are really, really pushing people into university again, which is so weird because we have a trades deficit here. There's like all kinds of programs where like if you sign up to be an electrician, they'll like pay for you and everything. And it's super weird. Okay.
Oh no. Yeah.
Yes.
It's not like.
I mean, I also, my parents were like, "Why are you going to university? You're so good with your hands. You should be an electrician or a mechanic." Like my uncles who all make good money. So like I have no excuse other than I just got brainwashed. But I mean, I don't know, man. Who knows, right? Like maybe they could have been right. And in different parts of the world, like in Florida, for example, electricians don't make anything, right? So it's I do not envy guidance counselors whose role it is to predict the job market 5 years from now, right at the end of a 4-year degree. So I wish the system could be more flexible. Like it's insane that you have to pick. On the one hand, it makes perfect sense that you have to pick a university or a college stream, because if someone's just not academic, why would you force them to be academic, right? But on the other hand, it's like, well, what if someone decides they want to be academic in 12th grade? Now they can't. There's no pathway. And it's even the colleges are stupid. Like the way we structure programs, there's no need for them to be so inflexible. Like there's no need that you must take these courses and only these courses. You and I are proof of that. Like we don't, I don't. Do you know what I mean? Like I spent the last 5 years in digital and I basically didn't study it in school. Anyway, it's. Yeah. Well, you're helping with it right now. This is why the podcast exists. Because, right? Because people are like, "Eric, I fucking hate advertising." Students are like, "Eric, I don't care about advertising." And I'm like, "Neither do I." But it doesn't matter, right? And you can. So with a few, I feel like, oh man, there's one other thing I wish we would have talked about, which was the boot camp thing. Because I get a lot of students saying, should I do a boot camp? And I'm always like, at the end of the day, it's your book that matters. But some boot camps will help you create a portfolio piece. But I guess we don't have to get into it. I've already taken almost 2 hours of your time. So. Software engineering. Oh, cool. Right. And you mean software engineering, I think. That makes sense. I guess you could look at it as basically you're just taking another course. Like, you know, and yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've never taken one. I've never taught in one. I don't know anything about them, but and I hear really mixed feedback. Although I think your summary is probably pretty, and I guess that's the other thing, like which UX, which boot camp. So we know Juno is a good one. That's good to know. Right. I think even software engineering might change soon. Like, right. Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting because people look at software and they're like, oh, there's like such a sharp learning curve. But I actually think people really underestimate the learning curve for design. Because it's like you make one pretty thing and it's like, oh, this person's a great designer. But it's like, no. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Wow. Well, oh, man, I mean, thank you. This has been really good. It's also just like nice on a personal level to talk to you. Like, it's a great conversation. Great. Well, I hope, and stay in touch. Yeah. If you're ever back in, I don't know how often you come to Toronto, but if you ever do, send me a message. Cause definitely good to get a beer or a coffee or whatever it is.
Great.
Thanks, Mark. Bye. Talk to you later. All right. Yeah, we're still here.